did it? Was it really Mr. Simpson or... We'll get to that later. Oh wait, you don't know what I'm talking about, right? It's about a famous case in which an NFL footballer, broadcaster and actor O.J. Simpson was tried for murdering his wife. This is Sri Ranjini and I'm your host for today's episode. Welcome to Forensic Diaries featured by The Forensic Times. Coming back to the case that I was talking about, Mr. Oriental James Simpson, also known as Orange Juice among his fans, was accused of murdering his ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman. Simpson and Nicole Brown were married for 7 years since 1985 and they had 2 children. It was not a happy marriage and he was also booked for domestic violence in 1989, after which they filed for divorce in 1992. Just to note another curious detail about Simpson, he had received military training, including the use of knife, for his unreleased pilot film called Frogman. Now I request you, my dear listeners, to please picturize this interesting case in your minds just as I start narrating it to you. To talk about the facts of the case, on the evening of 12th June 1994, Brown and Simpson both attended their daughter Sydney's dance recital, after which Brown and her family went to a restaurant called Mezzaluna where her friend Ron Goldman worked as a waiter. Ron Goldman was later appointed to return the glasses of Brown's mother, which he had forgotten on the table. At 12:10 a.m. on 13th June 1994, Brown was found murdered outside her Bundy Drive house in Brentwood. This was discovered by her neighbors, who were led to the scene of crime by her Akita dog. When the police was called in, they found Goldman's body lying near that of Brown's. She had been stabbed multiple times in the head and neck. There were few defensive wounds on her hands, implying a short struggle. The final wound inflicted ran deep into her neck, severing her carotid artery. Her larynx could be seen through the gaping wound and vertebra C3 was incised. Goldman's body lay close to a tree and there were multiple stab wounds on him. Near his body were a blue knit cap, a left-hand leather glove and the envelope that contained glasses that he had to return. A trail of the assailant's bloody shoe prints ran through the back gate. On the other hand, Simpson was scheduled to board a flight from Los Angeles International Airport to Chicago on the night of June 12th. The flight was due to leave at 11:45 p.m. and a limousine arrived early at Simpson's Rockingham estate to pick him up at around 10:25 p.m. The limo driver, who had come to pick Simpson to the airport, testified that he saw a shadowy figure head towards the south walkway where a bloody glove was later found. At 4:05 a.m., LAPD's homicide detective Philip Van Hatter arrived. At 5 a.m., he, Tom Lang and Mark Furman drove to Simpson's estate to inform him about the murder. The detectives buzzed the intercom at Simpson's estate for over 30 minutes but received no response. They noted that Simpson's car was parked at an awkward angle with its back end out more than that of the front, and there was blood on the door, which they feared meant someone inside may be hurt. In a walk around the premises, Furman discovered a blood-stained right-hand glove, which was determined to be the mate of the left-hand glove found next to the body of Goldman. The police contacted Simpson at his home on June 13th and took him to Parker Center for questioning. He voluntarily gave some of his own blood for comparison with evidence collected at the crime scene and was released. On 15th June, the DNA reports confirmed that the blood that was present at the crime scene and on the glove found at Simpson's estate matches with that of Simpson and the victims. On 17th June, the police informed Robert Shapiro, who was Simpson's attorney, that they had a warrant for Simpson's arrest. Robert told the police that his client would surrender at 11 a.m. as his medical treatment for suicidal depression was under process. The police agreed, believing that someone as famous as Simpson would not attempt to flee. They also agreed to delay Simpson's surrender till noon to allow him to be seen by a mental health specialist as he was showing signs of suicidal depression. He had updated his will, called his mother and children, and written 3 sealed letters, one to his children, one to his mother, and one to the public. Around 1,000 reporters waited at the police department, but Simpson did not turn up at the stipulated time. He had run away with his friend Al Cowlings, leaving behind the 3 sealed letters. At 1:50 p.m., Simpson was declared fugitive and an arrest warrant was issued against Al Cowlings. At 5 p.m., Kardashian and one of the defense lawyers read Simpson's public letter. Most interpreted this as a suicide note. Simpson's mother collapsed after hearing to it. The reporters joined the search for Simpson in what is famously known as the Bronco Chase. News helicopters reached the Los Angeles highway system for Cowling's white Ford Bronco. At 5:51 p.m., Simpson reportedly called 911. The call was traced to Santa Ana Freeway. At 6:45 p.m., a police officer saw the Bronco heading north on Interstate 405. When she caught up to it, Cowlings yelled out that Simpson was in the back seat of the vehicle and was pointing a gun at his own head. The officer backed off but followed the vehicle with up to 20 police cars following her in the chase. More than 9 news helicopters eventually joined the pursuit. The chase was compared to those that were shot in movies. It went on for so long that one of the helicopters ran out of fuel, forcing its station to ask another for a camera feed. Los Angeles streets emptied and drinks orders stopped at bars as people sat watching the chase on television. Every television showed the chase, be it ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, etc. The local news outlets interrupted regularly scheduled programming to cover the incident. It was watched by an estimated 95 million viewers nationwide. Simpson reportedly demanded that he be allowed to speak to his mother before he would surrender. The chase finally ended at 8 p.m. at his Brentwood estate. After remaining in the Bronco for about 45 minutes, Simpson exited at 8:50 p.m. with a framed family photo and went inside for about an hour. A police spokesman stated that he spoke to his mother and drank a glass of orange juice, causing reporters to laugh. Shapiro arrived and Simpson surrendered to the authorities a few minutes later. In the Bronco, the police found $8,000 in cash, a change of clothing, a loaded .357 Magnum, a US passport, family pictures and a disguise kit. Simpson was booked at Parker Center and was taken to Men's Central Jail, while Cowlings was booked on suspicion of harboring a fugitive. When Simpson was arraigned, that is, when he was informed about the charges against him and asked how he pleaded to the murders, Simpson firmly stated, "Absolutely 100% not guilty." The trial began on January 24, 1995, that is 7 months after the murders.
The case now begins to get interesting as we now come to the court proceedings. Let us see what the prosecution had to tell. Marcia Clark was designated as the lead prosecutor and Christopher Darden became Clark's co-counsel. They argued that Simpson's then-girlfriend, Paula Barberi, wanted to attend the dance recital of Simpson's daughter with him, but he did not invite her. After the recital, Simpson returned home to a voicemail from Barberi ending their relationship. Simpson then drove over to Brown's home to reconcile their relationship, and when Brown refused, Simpson killed her in a final act of control. Goldman, who came up to the scene to return the glasses, was murdered as well. The prosecution presented a total of 108 exhibits, including 61 drops of blood of DNA evidence allegedly linking Simpson to the murders. The volume of DNA evidence in this case was unique, and the prosecution believed that they could reconstruct how the crime was committed with enough accuracy to resemble an eyewitness account. They were so confident about the evidence. Clark stated in her opening statements that there was a trail of blood from the Bundy crime scene through Simpson's Ford Bronco to his bedroom at Rockingham. To list out the DNA evidence that was found in this case, Simpson's DNA was found on blood drops next to the bloody footprints near the victims at the Bundy crime scene. His DNA was also found on a trail of blood drops leading away from the victims towards and on the back gate at Bundy. Simpson, Goldman, and Brown's DNA found on blood on the outside of the door and inside Simpson's Bronco car. Simpson, Brown, and Goldman's DNA was also found on a bloody glove found behind in his home. The probability of error with these evidences was 1 in billions. To talk about the shoe print analysis, on June 19, 1995, FBI shoe print expert William J. Birdseye testified that the bloody shoe prints found at the crime scene and inside Simpson's Bronco were made from a rare and expensive pair of Bruno Magli Italian shoes. He determined that the shoes were of size 12, the same size that Simpson wears, and were only sold at Bloomingdale's.
Only 29 pairs of that size were sold in the US, and one of them was sold at the same store that Simpson often bought his shoes from. During cross-examination, Bailey suggested the murderer deliberately wore shoes that were the wrong size, which Bodzek dismissed as ridiculous. To talk about the hair and fiber evidences that were found on the crime scene, LAPD criminalist and hair fiber expert Susan Brockbank testified on June 27, 1995. He stated that the fibers from the glove found at Simpson's home microscopically matched the one found at the crime scene, proving that they were each other's mate. Both of the victims, the two gloves and the blue knit cap worn by the killer, had hair consistent with that of Simpson. The dark blue cotton clothing fibers were found on both the victims. The video from the dance recital that Simpson had attended earlier that night shows him wearing a similar colored shirt. Fibers that were only used in the 1993-94 year model Ford Bronco, the same car that Simpson owned, were found on both the victims, the knit cap, and on both the gloves. The glove found at Simpson's home also had hair and clothing fibers consistent with Simpson, Brown, and Goldman. It also had hair strands consistent with Brown's Akita dog. Let us now see what the defense had to argue. The team of defense lawyers was initially led by Shapiro and then subsequently by Johnny Cochran. Popularly called as the Dream Team, it summarized the evidences that were present in the court as compromised, contaminated, and corrupted by the criminalists, crime lab, and the police. They argued that the DNA evidence against Simpson was compromised by the mishandling of criminalists during the collection phase of the evidence, as Fung and Mazzola did admit to making several mistakes during evidence collection, which included not always changing their gloves between handling the evidence items, packing and storing the evidence items using plastic bags rather than paper bags as recommended, and storing them in the police van, which was not refrigerated for up to 7 hours after collection. This, they argued, would allow bacteria to degrade all of the real killer's DNA and thus make the samples more susceptible to cross-contamination in the LAPD crime lab. The defense also questioned the timeline, claiming that the murders happened around 11 p.m. as testified by Dr. Michael Baden, a forensic pathologist, and at that time, Simpson had an alibi. The evidence found on the back gate is indeed a mystery. The defense alleged that Simpson's blood on the back gate at the Bundy crime scene was planted by the police. The blood on the back gate was collected on 3rd July rather than 13th June, that is, 20 days after the crime took place. The volume of DNA on that blood was significantly higher than any other blood evidence collected on June 13th. The defense argued that it was unusual for that blood to have more DNA on it than the other samples collected at the crime scene, especially since it had been exposed to natural elements for several weeks and after the crime scene had supposedly been washed over. Coming to the evidence of the glove, on June 15, 1995, Christopher Darden surprised Marcia Clark by asking Simpson to try on the gloves found at the crime scene and his home. The leather gloves appeared too tight for Simpson to put on easily, especially over the latex gloves he wore underneath. The prosecution stated that it might appear to be tight because of the inflammation in his joints, or the gloves shrank from having been soaked in the blood of the victims. The prosecution also proved that a pair of new gloves of the same size fitted him perfectly. However, the defense concluded by stating their closing argument, which stated, "If it does not fit, you must acquit." The prosecution concluded their closing arguments by stating that, though Furman was a racist, that should not distract from the factual evidence that showed Simpson's guilt. Instead, stress should be laid upon physical evidence like DNA, the Bronco, and Simpson's lack of alibi during the time at which the murder took place. The verdict was to be pronounced on 3rd October 1995. Fears grew that race riots would erupt across Los Angeles and the rest of the country if Simpson was convicted of the murders. As a result, all the Los Angeles police officers were put on 12-hour shifts. At 10:07 a.m., Simpson was acquitted on both counts of murder. After the verdict in favor of Simpson, most black people surveyed said they believed justice had been served, with most claiming that Simpson had been framed, and some even suggesting that Furman was the actual killer. Most whites disagreed with the verdict and believed that it was racially motivated. Discussion of the racial elements of the case continued long after the trial's end. Now, my dear listeners, keeping aside the racial point of view and concentrating only on the evidences that were presented, the readers of the case are bound to think that both sides of the story may have been true. It may be true that Simpson was the culprit or that he was framed by the police, as there are evidence for both the views. It is now left to you, my dear listeners, to form your opinion. Thank you for your wonderful company for so long. If you want to be a part of this podcast channel, please email us at forensicdiaries@gmail.com. Sponsors can email us at the same email ID that I had mentioned above and can get featured. Thank you.